Hello and welcome to News Club, where we talk about the news and what we can do about it. It's in the title. It's pretty obvious. I'm here today with Debs Grayson and Tom Chivers. Tom Chivers from the Media Reform Coalition and Debs Grayson, a media activist, much renowned and researcher. And me, your host, B. We are going to be talking about some seriously fun stuff. Tom Chivers hates adolescence and is going to rant about how annoyed he is about that. Debs is going to tell us about activism in the UK, what we can do to support it, how we can get involved, and also what are the challenges it's facing, particularly around Palestinian protest. And I am going to ask the cheery question, is America a fascist state? So let's dive into it. Let's talk about, starting first and foremost, is America a fascist state? More importantly, let's broaden this out, because you know that can be a bit of a redundant question. It's the kind of thing you might see on Vox. We're better than that. We're going to talk about not only is it a fascist state and does that even matter, but what does this mean for us here in the UK? And most importantly, what should we do in this slightly new world, maybe totally new world? What are we going to need to do as people who not only want to know about the world and be informed, but actually do something to change it? So that's what I'm going to get into. Before I do, just quick check in. Tom, Debs, are you with me? Are you excited for this roller coaster?
I mean, I'm here.
I am also here to discuss the impending doom that's rollicking over the horizon.
Well, I just wanted to share with the audience the level of energy you guys are going to be bringing to the podcast this morning, because, yes, I am looking at some early morning faces.
This is the same face I have at meetings at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so I wouldn't oversell it too much.
Okay, well, hey, those are meetings. This is a podcast. This is us getting to talk about the world. Isn't this exciting? I sounded sarky there. I actually do think it's exciting. I very rarely get to actually say, flipping heck, you know, because, you know, I'm thinking, what am I going to do about all this? You know, what on earth is going on? And when you look at America, like, I mean, it's always tried to be the center of attention for the world, hasn't it? I mean, it's always had a pretty balmy place. Like, their left wing is far right and their right wing is off the charts. You know, that's always been the case. You know, they've got serious religious fundamentalism in their country, you know, deep and pervasive racism on all levels, not just in the institutions, but a level of bigotry that is quite hard to find elsewhere in the world. And, you know, a lot of other things besides. And that toxic brew has led us to the beautiful second Trump presidency. It's going to be beautiful. It's going to be great. So let's dive into the first question here, right? Like, I'm going to take these by parts and then drag you in, guys, and see what you think. So the first part is America a fascist state, and does that even matter? That's going to be a question that we've got to discuss, but also do we want to talk about what does that mean for us and what do we do about it? However, it is possibly kind of useful for once to actually discuss whether this is the case. I know we bandy about and we have bandied about accusations of fascism, but we may have crossed the Rubicon. Recently, you know, we have seen students being disappeared by unmarked police, put into vans without due process, without being taken to trial, without an arrest warrant for them, and then deported to mega prisons in El Salvador. We're seeing this with pro-Palestinian activists. For instance, a French researcher was denied entry because of their private messages that they sent on their WhatsApp and so forth, basically denigrating President Trump. And these were deemed, quote unquote, hateful messages, and therefore she was not allowed in the country. So you now can't message anyone about how much you think Trump is a lunatic and get into the US on your private device. So I guess we're all screwed. We're not going to America ever again. Rebecca Burke was a 28-year-old British cartoonist and backpacker who was detained by US immigration for 9 days without charge, put in prison and put in solitary with lights on 24 hours a day before being deported again because of criticism she put on her social media of President Trump. And we are seeing lots and lots of innocent people being rounded up as under suspicion of potentially being quote unquote gang members and deported to this El Salvador in prison. There's two sort of things that come to mind here before I hand over to you guys and ask you what you think of this. One is, I remember seeing this story from the daughter of Brazilian refugees in Britain who had fled fascism in Brazil, and they said people still get married under fascism. People still become doctors and lawyers, and they have careers and they have lives. Like, fascism doesn't happen equally to everyone. And the second thing is a thought about, you know, we don't end up at 1944 before 1932. Now, the problem is, and if we talk about Britain, for instance, there's been some pretty authoritarian moves. Face recognition software in every city soon, and it's being rolled out in many cities already, just permanently on all over the place. We're seeing meetings getting broken up to prevent quote-unquote public nuisance, and just police going into places of worship and breaking those meetings up. There's always authoritarianism, and as far as the state goes, it's always trying to get more power to discipline and control its citizenry. But I'm going to come to you, Chivers, first. Do you think we've crossed a Rubicon here in the US? Do you think this is 1932? This is the beginning of a sort of strongman autocracy, a dictatorship, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's trying to pull historical analogs is always very difficult because, you know, not to be sort of dweeby about it, but, you know, things always emerge very differently in different contexts. And like the way that kind of the new American fascism is emerging is unfolding in very different ways and through different processes than what we saw in the 1930s. I think, you know, we can go through the point of like, America has in many ways always been a fascist state since the 1940s and 50s. Like, there's always been the sort of the explosion of the military industrial complex, the like close alliance between corporate power and state power, repressive elements of the state and law enforcement and security agencies on like free expression, open belief, sort of dissident or oppositional forces within. And I mean, like, all of that is here today. I think what the key difference is now is like how open and brazen a lot of that is, and how in particular a lot of the sort of moves of fascism that are being perpetrated by the Trump administration, the government and the various security agencies is being done in a very openly sort of celebratory, repressive and fascist way. But I mean, I saw a clip the other day. I think it was some either Trump administration ghoul or like a Republican congressman or a senator or something stood in front of a cage of like hundreds of detained men who I think have been swept up in this sort of Venezuelan gang sweep. If you have a tattoo that looks vaguely threatening to a white suburban American, then you've been thrown in jail. And here's like a you know, an official of the US state stood in front of this cage of like imprisoned men, like bragging and celebrating and saying, this is what we are doing as a state. We are using our power and authority to violently and indiscriminately and potentially, you know, illegally, quote, and you know, the state can do what it likes in terms of laws, but like, you know, against all sort of due process and rights and dignity, just mass arrest people on the basis of like active political and racial discrimination. So I think that's the sort of the difference here is that through a mix of like new communicative platforms, the close embrace between the American powers of state and the sort of new frenetic style of social media posting and the sort of personality of this administration is much more openly, celebratorily fascist and repressive. So I think that that's a difference here. And I think that that's also against a backdrop of the way that the American state doesn't really seem to have the same grasp on economic and material issues in the way that like fascist states of the past have. Fascist states of the past have been all about controlling the centers of the economy and production for the benefit of the state and the corporate and the powerful and making sure that carries on. And there's elements of that in the Trump administration, but it's sort of like collapsing. All of this is collapsing. Every sort of basis and foundation of the economy is collapsing. And the Trump administration's response to it isn't like, oh, you know, let's take control of the commanding heights of the economy for our fascist purposes. Let's continue to deregulate and defund and remove money and power from the economy and funnel it up towards Elon Musk and Halliburton and all these major corporate powers. And it's sort of reaching this strange kind of point of collision between the obviously fascist instincts of the Republican Party under Trump versus or coming up against like the collapse of the nation state that is America and the way that a lot of these institutions and these relationships between corporate power and wealth are becoming more and more unsustainable because of the systems they've put in place. Where that goes from here, unfortunately, we kind of have to wait and see. But it feels like a mix of desperation and celebration in a way that a lot of what the Trump administration's doing.
What do you think about?
Yeah, I mean, well, as they say, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And of course, it's going to look different now than it has done previously. I mean, when the Nazis were on the rise, there weren't equivalents of Elon Musk and Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos, who have fortunes bigger than countries, and whose power and influence is not just within the nation, right? It's actually a genuinely kind of global level of influence. And I think you're right, Chivers, that there is this, it's like they've kind of grasped all the mechanisms of the state, but not actually to build a powerful and strong state, but to further empower these corporate interests. So at some point, these things will start to conflict with each other. And it's really unknown where that's going to go. I mean, even the kind of threats to invade Canada, it's like, what does that even mean? And I think it's really important, like you're saying, you know, fascism has always been here. It's just been unevenly distributed. I mean, if you hear people talk about what it was like to grow up in the projects in the 80s, like the level of policing, the level of like you leave your home and you could be disappeared by the police for, you know, a minor, you know, your tail light on your car is gone and now suddenly you're in prison. And that being the experience for Black communities and particularly for Black men. And plus, of course, when you think about what was not just happening within the US's borders, but outside of the US's borders, and all of the violence and much more explicit fascism that it's been supporting, and particularly in Latin America and obviously in Israel. But yeah, of course, it is a step change for it to know there's no longer this kind of group of people who are very obviously can be protected through their economic status, I guess. It used to be that you could kind of buy your way out of some of this level of fascism and violence. But now, you know, Nancy Pelosi might be actually at risk of her life without even doing anything particularly useful. Yeah. Like, yeah, there is obviously a step change. And I think it's important. There's that really good film called, is it called Good? And it's about this academic in Nazi Germany. And yeah, he just sort of gets kind of swept up within the Nazi regime. And what I think is really well done about that film is that it shows the rise of the Nazi Party, but through the eyes of someone who's benefiting from it. You know, they like his work. They quote his papers. He feels good about himself. And also, you know, he's going to these rallies and his wife is like, look how happy everyone is. Like, you have to acknowledge that for some people, fascism is nice and it's fun. And for lots of people, it's not that different, especially people who've already kind of understood that they're trying to create enclaves away from the state. For example, the growth of Mormonism in the US and the power of Mormonism is exactly this community who've understood we need to be creating all of our own institutions, our own economies, our own structures, owning our own guns. You know, they're kind of ready. And, you know, they're obviously not going to be resisting fascism. They're in lots of ways tied up with it. But that's kind of your exit from it is really to find yourself another strongman or another authoritarian community to be part of. That's the context in which you can have safety.
Well, we should come back to the context in which we can create safety. There's two threads I want to pick up and then I'll move on to the next bit, which is one thing I'd like to highlight that I think makes this particularly fascist is not just the repressive nature of the state. Like, I, you know, people, Joe Biden still, quite frankly, deported, it is still day by day deported far larger numbers of people, like, for instance. And at the moment, because Trump's way of running the state is so chaotic, he also imprisoned more people. So, like, the state has always been repressive and screws people over, including innocent people. And particularly in America, where if you're arrested, you have to stay in jail unless you can buy your way out. You don't get to go home and get charged at a later point and go through, you know, a proper process. You get locked up sometimes for years. So it's always kind of been brutal there. But what is unique about this is, I think, two elements. One is that it's all put behind one person, Trump. Trump is taking power away from the judges. He's attacking judges. He's trying to get them de-elected, get them arrested, accusing them of treason. He's also talking now openly about running for a third term, which, again, you know, we know that he probably wouldn't want to actually run in an election. And God knows what 82-year-old Trump is going to be like if this is 78-year-old Trump. So, but it, you know, the voice of the people internally are all speaking with his voice, and they mimic the way that he talks. They use his words, his speech patterns. It's really weird. It's genuinely cultish. And you know, I think when you look at fascism, which is an amorphous term, it is difficult because fascism is different in each country. It was different in Italy and Argentina and everything like that. It does tend to be about attacks on working class minorities, first and foremost, pick on the weakest so they can't resist you and break them first. And it's about authority being in a single leader, you know, and a cult of personality usually around that leader. Trump really has that in spades. He really didn't in the first term. There was a lot. And the problem is that I think liberal commentators went overboard in the first term. And now it's almost some of the critiques are meaningless. And people are like, well, if this is fascism, so what? You know, like, this is like, it doesn't feel any different. And if, and eggs used to cost so much more. It's, you know, like, sort of brings me to the second thing, which is the economy. And you're right that he's not trying to nationalize or centralize lots of elements of the economy, but what he is planning to do is do tariffs everywhere. And this is going to lead us on to how this all affects us, right, and how they affect us. Because yeah, fascism, America supported fascist governments, at least 50, 60, 70 fascist governments around the world in the past 50, 60, 70 years. Like, it's responsible for something like 80 or 90 coups. I have to find that out. Certainly at least it's over 50 coups, right, to install dictators. So there's always that foreign policy element as well. But what's unique about this is that tariffs are supposed to reshape the internal economy of the US. The regime is very focused on making America self-sufficient, basically in the face of climate change, actually. They're like, we want to get minerals, we want to get resources, we want them to be near us. Canada, Greenland, Gulf of Mexico will occupy the north of Mexico. You know, we're not going to bother about the rest of the world. It looks like, you know, they've actually managed to, through their tariffs, unite Korea, Japan and China together, and they're uniting the world kind of against them, and they're like, we don't care. What I have seen recently from the news is like lots of liberal commentators bringing out, we've got 64 Nobel, you know, I don't know how many it is, a dozen Nobel economists, Nobel Prize winning economists, saying these tariffs aren't going to work. Well, these economists all won Nobel Prizes during the past 55 years of utter misery, like, and declining living standards for everyone in the West, as well as like global slavery for all the children of the world who make our clothes, our shoes, mine our coltan, etc. Right. So these economists are not, they're also, they didn't predict any of the recessions. They didn't suggest any good responses to those recessions. So the liberals are really leaning on these kind of like experts who are not really good experts to make kind of, I think, false predictions or potentially false predictions, because I'm not entirely sure that these tariffs are going to damage the American economy in the way that they think it's going to. I think certainly in the midterm, it actually will potentially rebuild certain elements of industry within the US. And because America has huge amounts of money that it can invest internally and build out industrial bases that, quite frankly, everyone else doesn't have, because we can't borrow money against our currency. And because also all the capitalists live there and have huge amounts of money. So there is a potential that he's reshaping the economy in a way that actually benefits America. I think there will be short-term pain, and I do think you both are right that there potentially is going to be this clash. But I'm not entirely sure whether it's like, I think it might end up working out well for Trump. I don't know what you feel about that.
Yeah, I think on the economic aspect of the tariffs, I think it will be successful, but for all the wrong people. It will further create and concentrate inordinate amounts of wealth and productive control in amongst the corporations who already control large parts of the American economy. Like, there are already staggering levels of like poverty and economic inequality in America, and they're already getting worse. I mean, they were getting worse under the first Trump administration, they're getting worse under Biden, and they're going to get even more harsh and punitive under Trump. I think what the tariffs will achieve is basically shoring up the kind of domestic concentration of power and influence amongst American corporations who will be favoured by these tariffs and sort of have a sense of, you know, sort of a domestic economic advantage over, you know, foreign trade, as it were. But like, none of that money is really going to trickle out to the general American population. It might trickle out to like the small portion of the general American public who own shares in particular companies or have like their 401ks invested in certain areas. But it's just like, yeah, I don't think it will basically, it will hasten the like continued corporate state coalescence of what American economic power has been for most of the last 50 years, while like hyper accelerating the decline and impoverishment and destitution of most of the American public, in the way that like this isn't sort of we're putting in place these tariffs so that we will have more growth and government revenue to invest in public services. It is, we will have all of this money and power and wealth to keep in our bank accounts and to send off to shareholders and to further sort of consolidate power and wealth, while we're also cutting back on Social Security, on Medicaid, you know, public broad, or any sort of the minor semblances of any kind of like public institution that America has are being not just cut to the bone, they are being disappeared overnight by the Trump administration. So like these tariffs are, there may be like glimmers of economic growth for a tiny portion of the American public over a very, very long period of time. But what it will do in the short to long term is just continue the complete corporate consolidation of most of the American economy.
I mean, it sounds like he's taken some inspiration from Russia. What we've actually seen during this period of war is that even under like the most sanctions in the world, Russia is actually kind of all right because it has so much access to the things that it needs within its borders and actually just doesn't need to buy very much from the rest of the world. I guess the difference is that the dollar is the global currency, and that will be the thing that really shifts, is if he really goes for this much more insular way of thinking about economics, then probably a different currency will replace the dollar as the global currency, and that will have a whole bunch of other effects. But I think like what we can clearly see is that everything is extremely unpredictable. I mean, even if you think about Thatcher, I mean, in her first few years she was extremely unpopular, and then it was the Falklands War that really saved her. And I mean, you could absolutely imagine Trump starting a war as a means of like building up his own popularity again. And also there's something about, you know, what clearly doesn't happen is that people are kind of assessing their material conditions in this kind of isolated way, away from kind of more cultural concerns about a sense of their status. Or, you know, an example which is coming to mind is like, there was a period of time when towns in the US were actively competing to have a prison built in their town. And it was seen as like an engine of growth and a site of jobs. And even though obviously it's kind of horrible to have a prison next to you, like there's something like what I could imagine, Chivers, is that, yeah, you're not creating good jobs, right? These will be shit jobs with shit pay, with shit conditions, but there will be jobs. There will be factories reopening. There will be a sense of like something is happening. And for a certain set of
people, America is making stuff again.
Yeah, that might feel like there's a trajectory forward and a way that they can imagine life improving, even if there's really no evidence that they're going to progress in any way from like this shit job for Amazon or for, you know, this new shoe manufacturer or whatever to something better.
And the Trump administration is very good at making people feel. But like ultimately, you know, a lot of Americans, but a lot of humans are very divorced from material reality, particularly once you reach a certain level of comfort, even if things are getting slightly worse. You're not living in, say, the desperate poverty. If you're middle class in America, even if your living standards are going down, it's harder to get a house, you can't have kids, blah, blah, blah. Your material conditions aren't that of someone in poverty in the majority world, right? Like, and so often, even if you're in that situation, if someone in that situation, as things are getting like slightly worse incrementally, if someone can come along and make you feel something, anything to feel good, like that's Trump's magic, really. It's about how he makes people feel. It's about how a lot of them make people feel. And if it's lashing out some people and being angry at them and then being like really proud of yourself and our team and what we're doing, that's enough to carry a lot of people through what will be, you know, some really rubbish times, as you say, some shit jobs. Right, let's bring this home. I'm going to talk about what I'm calling Project 2029, because my assessment is, and I'll get your quick reactions on this and then we'll move on. My assessment is this: the effect that this has for us here is that liberal institutions, so things like the rule of law, as as poor a protection as it is, institutions like charities and other liberal institutions that relied on, like, what's the name, the investments abroad that we used to do, the sort of development programs and things like that. We've seen in America, they're all gone. Everyone I know in America has lost their job, right? Like, that's the way it is. Those institutions will go across Europe by 2029 because, for three reasons, really. One, people already hate a lot of liberal institutions. There's a sizable body of people who already just dislike them. And we're seeing this with people saying, yeah, I would like a dictator. You know, yeah, I would like to see significant change in any way, because just this going on is no good. And they'll be quite happy to see the rule of law end. Secondly, the economic consequences of the Trump administration, coming both from the tariffs, but also their withdrawal for support for the war that we are in with Russia. We are in a war with Russia. Like, people need to get on board. We're not fighting it directly, but we are spending money on it, and we're going to be spending a lot more on it against a country that's in a full war economy, is going to collapse or certainly degrade the living standards of people across Europe enough to erode that support for liberalism even further. And finally, the far right of America, particularly Elon Musk, is going to finance the far right of Europe with money, and also with their enormous global communication tools, which they control huge amounts of what everyone sees, thinks, talks about. And Musk has made it very clear that his control of Twitter is specifically to, you know, he by make it about himself. You have to talk about what he's talking about, you know, because you're going to see it on your feed, whether you like it or not. So in that arena, you've got febrile, you know, you've got right-wing parties that are already at 20-25% voting support, which is enough in a lot of European democracies for them to take power, actually. But they're going to be pushed over the edge by the declining living standards for everyone, and a lot of people's just dissatisfaction with liberal parties. Again, you know, we'll talk about the Labour Party, but one of the things they're doing with the headwinds to the global economy is go, okay, we need to make up 5 billion, which is not a huge amount, right? We're paying 110 billion a year on our debt repayments and interest on our debt repayments. So we've spent 5 billion a year, we're going to make £5 billion worth of cuts to push anywhere between 250,000 to a million people into poverty. Not only push them into poverty, which is going to create a moral outcry, it's going to affect a lot of people outside of those people in poverty. You, in a basic economic sense, you're just taking that money out of the economy. You're taking money out of people's pockets, and it's not getting spent, right? And because liberals are bad at economics and they're bad at sharing wealth, and because they refuse to look at, like, taxing the wealthy or redistributing wealth in any way, they are going to become more and more hated. So this is just one example of what I believe we will see over the next 4 years. So what do we do about it? We have to be prepared for 2029. We have to get ready. We have to do what Deb said. We have to be like the Mormons. We have to build our own institutions, but not around some bizarre cult that may or may not involve polygamy. I don't think we need to do that. But what I think we do need to do is look at building parallel institutions around food and energy and healthcare, not to necessarily replace everything, but to be able to provide enough for ourselves. I think we need to really look at how we can control the media and reform it. And I think we need to also be prepared to defend these institutions when the attacks come, when these right-wing governments get into power. Even if we don't like the institutions very much, we need to be able to prepare them. How do we do that? How do you do that? First and foremost, start a news club, right? It's get together, talk about the news, but most importantly, what you do about it. And each week, if you're, or every time you meet, if you're talking not only about the news, but what to do about it, you're going to come across more and more examples of what you can create, how you can create change. Change begins by coming together, by busting the myth of the late 20s. All change is on the individual. It's all the problems of the world are caused by you, and all the solutions must come from you. No, get together with some people, talk about the news, how to change it. That's what I'm going to do. Now, before moving on my assessment, what do you reckon? Am I being too bleak? I think at least plan for the worst and hope for the best. Do you know what I mean? It's my assessment, at least. Like, I can see very easily that we could be, that, you know, in 5 years, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I never thought I would hear you say be more Mormon. But, that, you know, that is exactly what I think of, like, needing to build these parallel systems. And at the moment, it might be the case of, you know, you're just building something quite small. You're sharing some ideas. You're trying out some stuff. And I do think that there is a general level of unpredictability that means that there will be opportunities, even in the context of, say, Farage taking power, as in, you know, we'll probably see one of the world's breadbaskets fail in the next 5-10 years. Like, we'll probably see some major disruptions to food systems. We obviously could have another pandemic. There'll be these moments of disruption. And I think also we obviously have a very centralized state in the United Kingdom, but we do have different institutions in Wales, in Scotland, in Northern Ireland. There is a push at the moment happening around devolution to the English regions. And I think that is actually very, very crucial, because if power can be kind of built up in these multiple centres, it just makes it harder for any one single authoritarian figure to wield as much power and to allow fascism to descend evenly everywhere. And instead, we kind of need to be, I do definitely imagine increasing authoritarianism from the centralized state. And then what you're trying to build is these pockets of security in particular places, which can then become kind of sanctuaries and home bases for people that are in more dire situations, which is exactly what we're seeing in the States, right? There's a huge amount of solidarity that is going on around abortion and supporting women in states who no longer have access to it to move over the state lines. That's the kind of direction of travel. It's kind of where we're already at, but there'll be an intensification. But we can learn a lot from the strategies of resistance that people have been using so far.
Yeah, I think on this point of building parallel institutions, it's clearly so important. And I'm just thinking about, like, what's currently going on in the politics that's already signalling the kind of paths that are coming up before us in the future of certain institutions. I mean, we're seeing at the moment literally the government surrendering even the most basic ideas of, like, regulation and intervention in tech platforms. Like, the digital services tax, a 2% tax on the revenues or the profits of, like, these major American tech companies. And now the government is saying, well, we're going to get rid of those because we really want to cozy up to Trump and we don't want to be on the receiving end of these tariffs. So we're starting to get rid of even the most basic sort of, like, public interventions of trying to claw back, you know, some sort of public good from these platforms which do not operate at all in the public interest. So it's already, like, an uphill battle to try and preserve not even institutions, but, like, basic ideas of the purposes of government power, for what it can do for the public and why there are ideas like taxes and regulations and interventions to curb private power and private abuses of power within the state. And, like, how that's going to unfold over the next couple of years with debates like the BBC Charter Review, or even trying to hold on to, like, really sort of simple but quite important foundations like the Human Rights Act or the Equality Act, or, like, these pieces of not sort of radical liberatory legislation, but, like, really basic pieces of, like, what it means to be a citizen and to have rights and protections from the UK state. And what, how are these sort of cardinal pieces of, like, the furniture of what it means to live and be a citizen in the UK, how are those going to, like, come up to the, like, as the front line of, you know, the culture wars and the oncoming sort of growth of fascist and authoritarian politics, as that front line moves further and further into our normal everyday lives, like, how many more pieces of this kind of civic furniture are going to be upended and destroyed as this moves? And yeah, what can we start doing now to, like, particularly make the case to a lot of very unfortunately complacent people who are sort of saying things like, well, as long as the Labour government only cuts these things by half as much as they're proposing, it might be okay. If only, you know, if we get rid of most of the disability living allowance or personal independence payment, but not all of it, things will sort of be okay and we'll have an economy, but without sort of sticking the poor and the destitute and the most vulnerable on the bonfire of human history. Like, trying to get across that point now that, no, these are all steps towards the kind of repressive, authoritarian, destructive onslaught that we're already seeing a vision of the future of in the US. Like, you've got to start now, and, you know, obviously think about what kind of alternative institutions and new liberatory democratic structures we will have to make for ourselves to guard against this in sort of 5 or 10 years' time. But recognizing that it's kind of already starting now, and the glimmers of it with things like Starmer rolling over sideways to pave the way for, like, Trump, to try and avoid Trump tariffs tearing down basic regulations and protections which we thought we could rely on in this country to basically avoid tariffs. Like, it's starting now, and it's only going to get worse, and like spotting these things sooner rather than later is going to be really important.
And can I just say, on the cuts, I did this little campaign website with some mates in 2010 called The Cuts Won't Work. It's actually still online somehow. And it said the cuts won't work, and it gave some reasons why, and it gave some alternatives. It was like, you could cut later, you could cut different, you could cut less, you could tax better, you could invest. Like, we were literally saying that stuff 15 years ago. Our economy is not in a better place because of all the cuts that happen. Like, it's absolutely insane to think that you're just going to do the same thing to a poorer, more unequal, more destitute country, and somehow this is going to create growth.
Well, on that note, that's why we've got problems ahead for the institutions that exist. So we do have to work together to fight to protect the good ones we have and build new ones. So I encourage everyone to start a news club. We're going to take a little break and we'll be back after the break. Activism is like dancing. And you think you can't dance, but you can. I thought I couldn't dance. I wanted to dance, but I was too afraid to step into a class. Twice I got right up to the doors, saw people inside and bottled it. Walked away. Third time, I had a plan. I invited a friend, the kind of person who picks up hobbies for 5 minutes and drops. I knew they wouldn't stick with it, but I knew they'd come along at least once. That's all I needed. Once I was in, it was fine. Everyone else was also shit. Maybe not quite as shit, but still. And after a few sessions, I got to know people, starting with nods and then hellos and then actual conversations. The fear faded. I even looked forward to it. And that's what activism should be like. The difficulty for us is believing that we can do something. And so getting involved in activism is just like learning a new skill. Dancing, pottery, sewing, running. You don't need to be an expert. You just need to start. Find a group, any group, and go along. Maybe it's not the perfect fit. Maybe it's not the exact issue you care about, but you're doing something. And once you're in, you can figure out the rest. Maybe start your own group. Maybe find a better group. Best way to start? Find a mate. Someone who will come once, maybe twice, just to get through the door. Because after a few months, you'll have new friends. You'll know what you're doing. And you'll forget how hard it was just to begin. And trust me, being an activist, it's joyful. Because instead of just hearing how fucked up the world is, you're doing something about it. And that's a far better feeling than despair. Well, we went away for a month and then like all the news happened in the like, I was like, what the fuck is going on? Are we going to be starting war? Like, are we going to war with America? Is that actually happening? Are we going
to
be fighting?
You can sleep easy at night knowing that Keir Starmer's too much of a fucking craven coward to ever start a war with America. Like, if there's one benefit of being him as prime minister, it's like, no, you know, when Trump fucking sends, you know, the USS Ronald Reagan to Greenland and start carpet bombing all of these tiny fishing villages with like a population of 2 people. You can sleep well at night knowing Keir Starmer's not going to lift a fucking finger.
You know, I don't think the Yanks are going to invade Canada, right? Like, because I think Trump's too, he's a fucking idiot, doesn't he? But Greenland, oh, he's like, oh yeah, 40,000 people. Yeah, I could take them. Do you know what I mean? Like, they sent over what? They sent over J.D. Vance with like 200 special operatives or whatever. And you're like, that genuinely is enough to take over that country. Like, those 200 people could take over that country. Do you know
yeah,
what I
in
mean?
The good old days of like gunboat diplomacy in the sort of late 1800s, early 1900s, it would have been like, okay, that's basically a declaration of war, right? You've brought a load of fucking state mercenaries to our island, to our, you know, to Denmark's crown dependency. That's yeah. A declaration of war. We're going to send our own little Danish special forces back to the White House and show you what we mean. But
it's going to be funny though. Like, Europe is reacting, EU element of Europe is reacting like in a way I didn't think they would. The investment in the military, while scary, I mean, the last thing we want to fucking see is the Germans rearming. Jesus Christ. But you know, they've relaxed those borrowing rules, which, you know, do that is going to cause internal investment and might protect their economies better, but also they might be in a lot of headwinds. I don't know. We're going to be fighting the fucking Russians as well. We'll keep following it. There's going to be plenty of geopolitics to talk about. Okay, so part two, Debs, let's talk about activism, because, you know, geopolitics and the state of America, that's going to be a filthy taste in our mouths.
Yeah, I mean, this is hardly cleansing the palate, but yeah, I thought it would be a good opportunity to talk about what's happening in Palestine and also what's happening with Palestine activism in the UK. Obviously, as you will know, Israel has restarted its genocide in Gaza. There's also been a big uptick in attacks in the West Bank, and things are looking extremely grim. Hundreds of people have been killed in Gaza, including, you know, children being killed on Eid. Hundreds of thousands have been told again to evacuate parts of Gaza, and it's really difficult to see what is going to happen other than the mass expulsion of those people from that piece of land, especially with Trump in the White House. It's not that Biden, clearly not that Biden was any better. It's just that there was an election happening. So there was a sense of like, there might be some change in policy at some moment. And now that's clearly not going to be the case. And Trump is fully on board with the mass expulsion of people from that piece of land and turning it into some kind of Trump theme park. Yeah. And then in the context of the UK, obviously, you know, there's protest and activism happening all around the world in solidarity with Palestine. And in the UK, there's lots of different groups that have been doing things. And I wanted to talk about Youth Demand, who I think are really interesting because, you know, it's obviously young people. They're kind of taking some of the tactics that have been used by Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil, but their message is tying together climate change and Israeli genocide and apartheid, which I think is really powerful and really strong because, you know, criticisms have been made of groups like Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil for having this very single issue view of climate change. And so it's very powerful to start to see people, you know, who have probably come out of those movements really being able to see all the links between these different issues. And they are completely interlinked because they're completely interlinked by the kind of financial institutions, by the corporate institutions. It's very often the same banks that are funding Israel and funding settlements and funding, you know, the arms trade, and that we're also funding the fossil fuel industry. And I think being able to see, I mean, quite aside from the fact that, like, obviously the destruction of the homes of 2 million people is like an absolute carbon catastrophe, like the kind of emissions that you see from a war zone are just absolutely astronomical. And so, yeah, to actually see what is happening, the genocide in Palestine, as sort of something that people that care about climate change really need to be on board with, I think is just very important. So Youth Demand have been doing lots of different protests, and then they've made this plan to try and shut down London over April, which is, you know, exactly the tactic that XR used in its first like big period of action. And they were having a meeting at the Quaker Meeting House in London last week, and the police broke down the door. They didn't even like ring the doorbells, like literally in the middle of the day. And like the people are just having a meeting, and they arrested a bunch of them there, and then they raided a whole bunch of other people's homes, and they've all been sort of released without charge but on bail. And so, you know, this is a very common tactic to kind of take the people that they think are organizers and say, you know, you're now going to face much bigger consequences if you participate in anything. Anyway, if you want to join any of their actions, you can go on their website. I would say, you know, they're running action trainings and legal briefings throughout this month. And I do think going to the legal briefings is really, really important, because especially if you've come out, you know, the climate of repression of protest is obviously mad. But even if you've come from environmental actions, if you're now for the first time coming and doing stuff around Palestine, you will probably be getting a worse response from the police. So it's really important that you know what your rights are, that you have a bust card, that you know what you would do in the case of being arrested. Also, how to try and avoid being arrested. Getting arrested is really shit. Don't do that in a way that's non-intentional. But yeah, I think there's obviously lots of other ways that you can participate in this movement to support Palestine as well. You can look up what the Palestine Solidarity Campaign is doing, look at what the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement are doing. Think about if you've got a pension, see if there's a divestment campaign for your pension to move its money. There's campaigns against Barclays, there's campaigns against Coca-Cola. You could go to your local shops and say, can you stop stocking Coca-Cola and instead stock Gaza Cola, this new brand that's come about that is, raising money to support people in Palestine. But yeah, it's obviously like such a vital issue and such an acute situation. But there are things that you can do about it if you kind of look up these organisations and try and get involved.
But just before I bring you in, Chivers, I had a couple of reflections. One was that I went to an environmental meeting recently, and as an old environmental activist, I hadn't realised how little you can do nowadays in terms of protest. And it's really hard if you're not an activist to understand like how scary it is, how unnerving it is to realize that you can't do things that you thought were basically, coming together and spending time together. I mean, they really do want us alone in our rooms together. They shut down all the pubs and the clubs and don't spend time together, don't do anything but be on your phone. We're going to shut down all the social centers and community centers, and there's nowhere to go on this rainy little island. And if you do ever want to come together to do anything political, we're going to arrest you before you do anything political for thinking about it, for talking about it with other people. You can think about it in your room, in your head, as a daydream. It's sometimes what it feels like. And particularly when the arrest organizers, the other thing I wanted to note is that in the bail conditions, that means they can come and search your house like whenever. And for instance, after this, they all went and raided everyone's houses at 2 a.m. And I know people who have been through this, where you would get every week or so just raided at 3 a.m. because that's what they try to do to intimidate you. Having said all of that, it's still not legal to come together and do things about the world. And Debs has pointed out all of those things. I think one of the things that we're going to want to do is, referencing the last part, is to try and protect civil liberties as much as possible, our freedoms to be together and to do things. And these are now going to be not only fights for the campaigns themselves, but for our rights to be able to be together, to make change. So we really need to dive into this. And as I say, start off by meeting together, talking about the news, what you're going to do about it, join these groups, look at the campaigns you can be part of, and then, yeah, have chats with your local shops and things like that. Chivers, how did you find these stories, and particularly the terrible stories of what's happening in Palestine and Gaza?
Yeah, horrific. And it sort of contributes to the just, what we talked about a lot on this show is that all-pervasive sense of just like, everything is really, really horrible and getting worse all the time. And, a lot of the stuff that, different campaign groups and activist groups are doing to raise awareness of it is like fantastic and powerful and important, but also up against this like rising tide of things getting worse and worse and worse. Not to say that like protests can't do anything, but like it's just the current state of how things have been getting exponentially worse in Palestine, how the kind of repressive acts of the state here and in America have like really ramped up, especially in the last 6 months or so, as Deb said, now that the sort of the ceasefire came and went, and now the genocide has come back with a vengeance. I think what's stood out for me, and like from my own personal experience, is seeing like how in protests on Gaza and Palestine, how like a lot of these repressive movements by the government and the police here in the UK has really started to shift sort of general public perceptions and consciousness towards protest as like a basic mechanism of civic expression and communication and public participation. We're sort of, if I think back to like a lot of the Extinction Rebellion protests where, it was people blocking roads or, getting up onto bridges or billboards to like block traffic and make a statement about this stuff, and how quickly a lot of the political and police response on that was geared very much in a way to like make ordinary people angry about the inconvenience of protests and how these people were being very selfish and rude and like interrupting their everyday lives as a way to completely distract from the substance and the power and like the importance of the message that the protester was trying to get across. And I saw that, I was in town the other week, just sat in a cafe, and like for about 3 or 4 minutes, there was a sort of, a pro-Palestine Stop the War in Gaza kind of silent march protest. I think there was about 10 or 15 people. They may have been from the local university, walking through with placards saying free Gaza, end the genocide, stop UK support for Israel. A very sort of, encouraging, inspiring, small act of protest by a local community group. And just in the sort of 5 or 10 minutes they were walking past the cafe while I was like, that's really good to be happening, I should go and talk to them after, I saw about 10 random members of the public go up and start accosting these protesters. And I couldn't hear what they were saying because it was on the other side of a cafe, but just thinking, like, these surely aren't, like, rabid pro-Zionist, anti-Palestine, hate-filled warmongers. These are just sort of members of the general public who are seeing a protest and reacting in a way of, like, how dare you go out and express yourself? Who do you think you are, you know, interrupting my pleasant experience on the high street by walking through and wearing placards and, you know, shouting slogans? I think that's sort of one of the sort of corollary effects of all of this repression on the protests themselves is like a really substantial change in public attitudes and consciousness towards protest, where previously it was treated as like, you know, a sort of maybe a sort of nuisance or a thing to ignore. And maybe if you saw enough of them, you'd start to pay attention to the message and wonder, what is it these people are protesting about? The scale of the repression and the denigration of climate protesters and now Palestine protesters has, I think, had a real, like, substantive psychological impact on how the general public perceives us protest as a means of public communication. And that's, like, that's kind of really worrying in the sense of, like, what can protest achieve when you're going out there to try and convince ordinary members of the public, to make them aware of what's going on, to try and raise their concerns and get them interested and concerned with you about it. Like, all of these efforts are seen to be just, like, to destroy the concept of protest as something that is completely legitimate and important in a democratic society.
And something that I forgot to mention in the first segment was about what dehumanization allows. We talked about it in a previous episode, and Debs, you brought it up about, like, when you dehumanize immigrants, and in this case, dehumanize protesters, human beings become things. They become things rather than people, and things that you can feel any way you like because they don't deserve to be treated as another human being. You can feel any way you like, and you can act any way you like to them. You see people have tried to run protesters over in their cars. You don't mind people who are immigrants or people who don't look like you being rounded up and detained by people without trial. You're glad. There's some joy in seeing these things, bad things, happen to these things, not these people, not these human beings, that you can feel any emotion with. And that is the, so often when we are doing media activism and we're talking about, like, you can't dehumanize people, you shouldn't be talking about people as swarms or like as this and that, and using these pejorative, not just pejorative adjectives, but dehumanizing adjectives that creates this distance between us and other humans. When we're doing that, it often seems a bit like we're policing thought or speech or just something distant that doesn't really have a real world effect. This is the real world effect that we all are okay with, and some people are celebratory of attacks on people's right to protest. And whatever you feel about protest, and hopefully if you listen to this, you're kind of for it, it's important because it's the only way that anything useful changes. Having said that, it's not the only way. And we will keep talking about all the other ways that you can support those things, cooperatives, trade unions, you know, community organizing, single issue campaigning, lobbying, etc. We're going to talk about all of those. Debs, any final thoughts on this before we talk about why Chivers hates adolescents?
I mean, I think it is also important not to overstate how positively people felt about protest, for example, in the 2000s. But I do think that there's been a shift. I don't think protesters were seen as dangerous then. I think protesters were seen as irrelevant, annoying. You know, there was definitely a generally quite an apolitical culture. And then I think maybe there's been a period in between, maybe in the 20s, when protest was kind of cool. And now we've moved into a space where, protesters are seen as kind of dangerous. People have definitely been very encouraged to interpret their sense of annoyance, inconvenience as symbolic of a wider kind of breakdown in morals. That is a sign that, you know, it's obviously there's definitely a generational side to it as well. Like, usually the people that I've been harangued by most have been quite old. There's something about, but it is true that, for example, with this thing with the youth demand, it did seem to overstep. Like, I watched a clip from Talk TV, which is, you know, and the guy was like, well, I might not agree with what these young people wanted to do, but of course, I think it's ridiculous that they would knock the door down of a house of worship to arrest these people. So yeah, I do think that this kind of preemptive arrest of meetings of people who are doing things which are seen as quite respectable. And it is true that Youth Demand, everyone that I've seen speaking for them, has seemed to be pretty middle class and white. So yeah, they're presenting a kind of respectable face of protest, and obviously it looks and feels differently when the people that they're arresting or that they're targeting are black and brown people who are also trying to assert their kind of rights to free speech.
Yeah, interestingly, and then we'll break for the thing, I've noted a lot that actually, whilst there has been, obviously there's this kind of fake protection of free speech from the right, they're also the only ones currently who are against some of the quite restrictive laws of the, for instance, the Online Safety Act and other things, because some of the laws do overstep the bounds and do infringe on freedom of speech. And at the moment, what we have, I think this is a discussion for another time, it's worth thinking about, is that the left and liberals in particular have gone, well, fuck you guys, because you're a bunch of knobs. We're seeing it today. You know, someone has been given a custodial sentence for writing an aggressive email to a head teacher, right? Fuck, and clearly they were not a pleasant person, and this was not a pleasant email, like, and so it's hard to feel any sympathy with them. But then it must be really hard if you're right wing to feel any sympathy for a pro-Palestinian protester. And we might have to recognize that we have given the state some extreme powers here, and even if it's being used against people that we think are pretty grotesque, we don't necessarily want them to end up in prison or being policed by the state. I'd rather shame them online, you know, or whatever, or have a discussion with them and talk about why they're idiots, rather than like police coming around and locking a lot of these people up. So this will probably be an ongoing discussion for News Club, and I'm glad we've opened it up here. Right, we're going to have a little break, and then we're going to come back and talk about why Chivers is so misogynistic. Right, brilliant.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Media Bias 101, where we talk about how, yes, the mainstream media is lying to you, but in so many different ways. I'm your host, Sneakrit, and today we're going to be talking about partisan bias. Now, partisan bias is probably the main thing people think of when you talk about biased media. But why is that? Well, it's because it's one of the easiest forms of media bias to spot, whether you're talking about it as a preference for a political party in particular, or just a commitment to a particular political ideology. Whenever we talk about biased media, we normally think of partisan bias as the be-all and end-all. And this is why you'll often find that when you talk about biased publications, you're looking at it on a simple linear scale of left-wing to right-wing. But it's kind of simplistic. You'll have overt political bias and partisan bias from publications. For example, they'll endorse a specific party during the election, or they'll make it very clear in their opinion pieces or their sources that they're favoring one particular ideology. However, the danger with this form of bias and thinking that we've spotted it is the publications that sit in the neutral zone. But why is this neutral zone so dangerous? Well, because humans are generally very good at spotting bias when it explicitly goes against their ideology. But by positioning something as neutral on the political spectrum, just because they don't explicitly support something, you get a blind spot as to what to look for and how to critically understand the media that you're consuming. Because the thing is, even if a publication sits in this neutral zone, that doesn't mean that they're not exhibiting bias in the stories that they choose to cover, following after their own commercial interests, using spin language to push a particular talking point. And it's not what makes them reliable. But what do those different forms look like, and how do you spot them? That's what we're going to be covering in the rest of this series. So if you want to hear more, make sure that you subscribe to News Club and keep checking back for more updates.
Take us home, sweet Chivers.
Yeah, it's always, everyone tries to end a podcast on like a sort of fun, jokey story. And this week our fun, jokey story is toxic masculinity and violence against young women. And
we're going to have to really do better in our research the next one. And audience, I'm sorry, we went away for a month. Everything happened. Yeah. Like, it's, you know, we'll be back with some lighter stuff next week, I promise. Or more invigorating, joyful, and inspiring stuff. But anyways, yes, toxic masculinity.
Yeah, so this is Adolescence. This is the latest hit Netflix drama about a teenage boy who murders his female classmate, and then each episode of the show kind of goes through different moments, like the process of him getting arrested, the police interviewing other pupils in the school to try and find out what happened, the murderer's interview with a psychologist, with the psychologist trying to understand the kind of mentality and the roots of why he committed this murder against a teenage girl, and then looking at the experience of his parents kind of living through the aftermath of having a violent, misogynist, Andrew Tate-inspired murderer for a son. I mean, as a show, it's fine. It's sort of technically impressive. Each episode's done in like one-shot takes. That's kind of cool to see how they, you know, they had to physically take the time to record single takes of what they were doing. The young actors in it are very good. It's sort of, they're very powerful, well-acted moments. But actually what's really got me pissed off about this show is the kind of political response to it. Or more accurately, the completely embarrassing, pathetic politician and media commentary at Lovin with Netflix, which is all about having conversations and shining a spotlight and talking to your children, rather than actually like directly tackling the root causes of toxic masculinity and online indoctrination that's poisoning many, many young men. Or even, like, most importantly, and the bit that the show itself kind of completely overlooks, is what can be done to try and stop the horrific, violent and repressive impact of this kind of new culture on young women. Like, that's something that the show itself doesn't even talk about, like the impact on the family of the murdered young girl or on her friends or on young women more generally. A lot of the focus on the show is like, oh, his parents are really sad that he murdered this girl. What a horrible thing for them to experience. Like, it's all sort of passed off as secondhand. So that's like part of my problem with the show. But like, yeah, the political response to it, I think, has been epitomised by Keir Starmer meeting with the show's writers and with Netflix executives in Downing Street to praise Netflix for making the show free for schools to show to their students, which, by the way, is such an obviously fucking impotent and pathetic way to think about addressing toxic masculinity, as if like something in this show is going to be new or shocking or revelatory to 13-year-olds, you know, even if it has led to a lot of kind of pearl clutching from liberal commentators in very comfortable backgrounds who are just like, oh, I didn't know schools were a little bit messy these days. Gosh, those pupils are very loud. Golly, it looks like it must be horrible to be arrested by the police. Like, that's sort of been the primary reaction of the show, is like, it depicts some things that are a bit heavy, but it doesn't actually address, like, where this culture of toxic masculinity is coming from, what the actual content that young men are being exposed to, young women are being exposed to, and sort of objectified and humiliated and, you know, had horrible sexual violence directed against them because of this content. Like, none of that is in the show. It's all about the slightly awkward, iffy experience of this murderer and his family. But then in this meeting, like, Starmer, who, let's not forget, is like the Prime Minister of the UK, right? He has actual power to do stuff, goes on and on about how the show was brilliant for starting conversations, for shining a spotlight on the issues, like, you know, generally really vague stuff, not actually saying what are the issues, what is the horrifying content that needs to be stopped. But like, one of the, he said, the thing that really stuck out to me, what he said was, there isn't an obvious policy response to these questions, right? So the government response is, making a Netflix show free in schools is a really good way to address toxic masculinity, but we couldn't possibly do anything like providing free youth clubs as spaces for like young men and women to interact away from social media, or providing universal access to mental health support and care for people who are struggling with their understandings and growing up. Not about free school meals as a kind of social lever. None of these things that like a government can actually tangibly do to try and address some of the underlying root causes. Certainly not like regulating online platforms, or, you know, trying to actually have control on the kind of violent, horrifying, illegal content that's on social media. Not doing anything like that. But making sure that you sit down a bunch of 13-year-olds in a classroom to watch a pretty middling TV show about something that's just like, you know, that's really what's pissed me off about it. Not so much the show itself, though I do have like major issues actually with what the actual narrative and focus of the show of adolescence is, but just the pathetic surrender of political responsibility for dealing with this really deeply dangerous and serious matter of toxic masculinity, surrendering responsibility for dealing with that to a fucking streaming platform, and the Prime Minister basically providing state PR for a couple of episodes of TV with Stephen Graham in it. Like, it's just, it's such a, like,
hey, really that was pathetic. Some pretty good TV, I hear.
It was okay. It's not like, it's not going to blow you away. But I also, like, there's another element to this, which is like, it's another sign of the kind of powerlessness of TV drama as a mechanism for inspiring and making political material change actually happen. You know, people have been talking about like Kathy Come Home, which was a 1960s bit of socialist realism, actually not social realism, socialist realism, about done by Ken Loach about unemployment, poverty, the corrupt rental sector, homelessness. It's credited, like, Shelter was launched just before Kathy Come Home came out, and it's sort of credited with really helping to raise the public profile of Shelter. Homelessness is still a really big problem in the UK. So maybe this kind of TV drama, which everyone lauds for talking about homelessness, didn't have the kind of impact that people praise it for.
Again, hold up. Come on now, Chivers. It would have given impetus to tackling the homelessness.
It did. I'm not
homelessness
saying it did
nothing. Re-became a big problem.
Sure.
It didn't stay static. I think when you look at the US, you see that actually what they're very good at doing is engaging in culture over material change, actually, to make people feel things and move them on issues and then create material change from it. And I think those cultural moments, again, we saw it with the post office drama. We didn't.
We haven't seen it. That was an issue in the public domain for over a decade. Right, that was being... There was real investigative journalism about the post office scandal, and it was there in the domain for decades. People were still being arrested or prosecuted up until 2 years ago, and now this political drama's come out and exposed it, and lots of politicians have been patting themselves on the back for saying, hasn't this... And, like, nothing's been really done about it. Like, the prosecutions are still there. There's not been any kind of, like, amnesty or, you know, there's still... People have still lost a lot of money from this, and people have still... There's not been any sort of retribution from it. It's brought it to political attention for a couple of months, but, like, the underlying corporate corruption and cover-up is still there. In the same way that, like, yes, you know, Shelter had a massive burst of, like, public support, and homelessness is dealt with in a very different way. It didn't change the material way in which politicians, people in power, actually approach these questions.
But that's as much on organisers as anyone else. Like, if it, you know, Shelter did take advantage of Kathy Come Home, I don't think, like, there was a vehicle for people to pour their outrage around the post office scandal into. You know, I think you can take cultural moments and be prepared for them. I think, for instance, when we're working on media reform, one of the things is we're preparing for that moment when people really give a shit about it again, so, and saying, we've actually got some answers and you can come and join us. Like, that's what you've got to be doing. Like, organisers work away in the background. But because I think with the post office drama, they were working on legal cases, that's a problem. And because it's not a movement. And I think, by the way, that's why 10 years of investigative journalism didn't go anywhere, because they didn't form a campaign group or anything, you know. And that's something I think the audience can take away with them. It's like, if you want to create change, you've got to create an organization that becomes a vehicle for the moment that people actually are interested to get involved and actually do something and make change. Because, yeah, you're right, like, a couple of months of outrage, which, by the way, is quite a significant amount of time for outrage to occur, more than a day is impressive. Right, a couple of months of outrage not being utilized is still not enough. It's not sustained enough impact. And of course, if it's not being channeled, it will not create any change.
I mean, my problem here is not with organizers or people who bring these issues to public light through drama or culture or art or different kinds of public interpretation. My problem is what it kind of reveals about the underlying logic of the relationship between media and politics, and the way that all of these ideals, these kind of foundational ideas about, like, the media is there to inform the government and to tell them about problems that are happening in society. It's been doing this, you know, campaign groups, journalists, investigative reporters, not the kind of, you know, headlines of newspapers or major TV reports, but, like, the background hum of journalism has been talking about homelessness, poverty, post office scandals, corruption and cover-ups, toxic masculinity for years and years, as long as they've been going on. But it's like politicians can sort of brush those under the carpet unless and until it becomes some sort of, like, spectacle headline grabbing thing for a couple of months. And then their response isn't to kind of put their hands up and say, yeah, we're sorry, we've sort of realised we've fucking fucked up on this and completely ignored it. And now we've, you know, the tide of political and public attitudes to this is too strong for us to ignore and we simply have to do something. The response is, make a show free. Make a Netflix show free in schools. That'll solve the problem. We're not going to really do anything. The problems are too complex. There's no silver bullet, Keir Starmer said. So we don't have to do anything. We can just make this show free in schools. 13-year-olds will watch it and go, yeah, I know who Andrew Tate is, mate. Why are you making me watch this? Can I go now? And, like, the government are not doing anything. So, you know, bravo to the producers of Adolescence for making a very technically impressive and probably not that actually narratively interesting show. Bravo for Keir Starmer for finding another excuse not to fucking do anything.
Well, these are the basic dynamics of communicative capitalism, as Jody Dean described it quite a long time ago, and it has only got worse since then, of, like, Yeah, there's endless opportunities to have discourse about a thing and ever narrowing opportunities to have any kind of influence over the way that decisions are made by those in power. I guess it also makes me think of, you know, that whole moment around sex and relationships education that happened a couple of years ago, the big kind of scandal. There was a culture war moment around it where they said that these organizations that were going into schools were teaching kids about, you know, rimming or something. And it was, you know, based on some completely inflated, or it was basically, you know, a particular individual who was employed by one of these organizations in their adult sex education classes had some materials on this kind of thing, or like choking. I think it was choking. That was the thing that they were getting very cross about. But this obviously wasn't a thing that they talked about in schools. And I actually have a friend who worked for one of the organisations that ended up being kind of, you know, on the chopping block at this moment. And her describing what it was like to go into schools and try and run these sessions, she was very much, she wasn't trying to do sex education. She was trying to talk about consent. But the kids were not at all interested. What the kids wanted to talk about was sex. What the kids wanted to do was to, you know, for her to, she was like, if I went in and did the thing that the culture war warriors said I was doing, the kids would have been so much more engaged. But yeah, this, I guess we always have to see these conversations as like, in some ways, perennial ones about like, what are the youth doing? We don't know what's going on. And these difficulties of like how you have like truthful, intimate conversations about what is going on in young people's heads when they're precisely at a moment when they're really like, there's big social penalties if you actually go to the adults about any of your problems. And then we're in this moment of what the online spaces allow for, obviously the kind of social media platforms, YouTube, but also like the gaming platforms, like they allow for these interactions to happen between adults and young people that sometimes their parents literally have no insight into, it's different than when like we were kids and like you might watch the TV late at night and maybe you'd watch a film that scared you and maybe you'd watch something that was kind of pornographic. At the very least, your parents could like flick through the Radio Times and maybe understand what it is that you might have watched. And like there's something in this anxiety about this disconnect between generations. But there also are, yeah, it's like you're saying, Shiv, is like the levers and the mechanisms. Keir Starmer's saying there's no silver bullets. It's like, no, there's no silver bullets, but there also are clearly understood and defined ways of creating spaces where young people can have much healthier relationships with each other and with adults who can model better behaviours to them, for example, with youth workers at their youth club. Or this thing of like, you know, reinstate this stuff around sex and relationships education that got shut down by the Conservatives in the context of this culture war, and actually be trying to create these spaces where young people can be encouraged to talk about consent in this, yeah, consent and boundaries and what is a good way to treat each other in this context that is not like a lot of what they kept saying in this culture war moment was it should be the teachers. Why are you bringing in these external people? It should be the teachers. It's like, but the teacher is precisely the person who's in this like institutional role who they're never going to be honest with. They're not going to be able to say what is going on for them. And it's, you know, it actually played out in the Rotherham scandal as well and the grooming gang stuff, that there were particular organisations who were working there who had the relationships with the young people where they knew what was going on. And they were not supported. And in fact, they were shut down. And so, yeah, I suppose it is, I totally agree, Shiv, that there's something very, very frustrating about like what you have to build and you have to support is the social infrastructure, which allows young people to become part of community. And that means engaging with adults who are not their parents, who are not their teachers, who are not some YouTuber who has gamed the algorithm. And allowing them to come into some sense of who they want to be as an adult, who they could be as an adult, that's not just within these like clear, these relationships where there's these clear big divides of power between them and the adults around them, which just means that they like put the walls up and you'll never know what's going on.
Yeah, and I think crucial, like there's another element to that is like, you know, participation in media is also like something which is completely shut off for young people, right? In all these conversations I've seen about adolescence, it's been parents talking to other adults about, like, I watched it with my children and I was shocked. I couldn't believe this. I've not yet seen any kind of mainstream media outlet interview a young person and kind of ask them, hey, do you see this stuff? What's your experience of, like, toxic masculinity? There's no... This is something that's, you know, been going on in sort of, like, charity spaces and children's rights groups. It's like, children are kind of... It literally seen and not heard in the media, right? The voices and perspectives of children themselves and young people to talk about their own approaches and perspectives on these issues. It's just something that never comes across the minds of, like, mainstream media commentators. And, like, this show could have been an amazing opportunity. And there's still an opportunity for it to become this, but, like, a space to, like... involve young people in a national conversation through the media, through these platforms that are meant to be like there to represent the public voice and to shine lights on difficult issues. But so far it's just sort of commentators patting themselves on the back and saying, oh, aren't we brilliant for noticing this all of a sudden?
Well, look, here's the thing. I'm gonna push back against that a little bit, because that bit is on us. Like, I don't think we should have expectations of institutions that do what they do to do anything but what they do. This has opened a cultural moment. Weirdly enough, last year, a friend of mine who does sort of anti-fascist community organising and works with young men, usually young men who are excluded in some way from schools, he'd been telling me that over the past couple of years, he's like, they walk in and they say verbatim, word for word, what Andrew Tate said. Like, they're saying these things, like, actual. And he said, they're saying things that I never used to hear, because he worked with young men for a long time. I didn't used to hear them saying these things and acting that way. And the way that they are thinking about how they treat women and people is mind-blowing to him. And then a couple of months ago, I was in a room with a couple of teachers, and they started telling me, like, you know, they're female teachers, and, you know, what they are, the way they are being treated by young men, you know, they hadn't experienced in the previous decade. But, you know, young teenagers are getting up and saying, you can't teach me, you're a woman. Like, that's fucking crazy to me. That was news to me, right? And I'm aware of how polluted this space is, this information space is, and how toxic people like Andrew Tate are. Partially, by the way, because it has to be acknowledged, because he's charming, convincing, engaging, and more, right? Like, it had, so he's a very dangerous person to kind of, like, deal with, because if you just make him out to be rabidly disgusting, which he represents disgusting points, you're going to be seen as someone who, like, doesn't recognize, like, that, you know, sometimes he's kind of funny for, you know, basically someone who's also a criminal, probably, allegedly. Seemingly. But we as a culture are not dealing with that as an entire nation, right? Like, if I hadn't known teachers, I wouldn't know that that's what they're going into school and saying, right? Like, so this show comes along and people start talking about it, then it's on you and me, Tom and Debs, particularly yourself, you work in media reform, to go, this is what needs to happen. And fantastically, actually, for the audience and to bring us home, we're going to be doing an interview with Adele Zeynep Walton, who wrote a brilliant book that will be coming out at the end of this month or beginning of next month, called Logging Off, The Human Cost of the Digital World. And I started reading it and then I immediately stopped because I wanted to read it just before I did the interview with her, and look out for it when it comes out, because I wanted it to be fresh, because there's some great lines in there. But one of the ones that stuck with me is that, you know, we decided we needed seatbelt laws. It's that we didn't decide that we needed to stop driving cars. We just needed seatbelt laws so that less people were dying because of cars, because of driving. We can do the same with the internet and information, because in the book she charts the people who are dying, you know, she charts, like, a story, I don't want to give it away, actually, again, really eye-opening stuff that I was just not aware of, and again, I'm living in this space, so I think a show like this is really important. If it gets people talking about this, I think we can go further. That's our job. So I think adolescence has been useful in bringing to light something that was maybe only spoken about in certain circles. And hopefully here today, we've talked about it and talked about other things in an interesting way that helps bring it further to light. But let's talk about, as we go on, what those seatbelt laws for the internet would look like. Let's talk about how we can make our world a bit of a better place. And let's encourage you guys to go out, form your news clubs, spend time with other people talking about not only the news, but what we do about it, because that is how we're going to see a better world for all of us.